There you go. You want to know what the building blocks are of the universe of reality? Radney Foster says it's hammer and nails. That's from 1993, and Mr. Foster is yet another of those Texas troubadours, great singers and songwriters that just seem to crank out of Texas all the time. We're talking with Dr. Ruth Kastner about her book, Understanding Our Unseen Reality. I hope you're having as much fun as I am talking about the nature of reality, of consciousness. In a moment, we're going to touch on the idea of free will. If you didn't know that physicists talk about the idea of free will and have equations for figuring it out, well, you're about to learn that, and then we'll open up the phone lines and see what's on your mind. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Ruth Kastner, you know, these are big issues, and I'm having so much fun hearing you sort of help us understand them. Talking about something existing beyond space and time, I wonder, is it knowable? Is it something we, I know we're having trouble wrapping our heads around it now, but is it in fact knowable? Do we know for sure if it is?
Well, we can't know for sure in the sense that we can't test it. We can't check it with observation because that's the whole problem. That's, once again, physics kind of reaching the end of its domain. And certainly many philosophers distinguish between this phenomenal level, the classical space-time level, and this underlying level. Kant was one who called it the noumenal world, which is a sort of a fancy word for saying things as they are in themselves, having not been perceived by anyone. And of course, there are some philosophers who say there's no such things, that things only exist if they are perceived. I disagree with that, of course. And what I claim is that quantum theory is describing this so-called noumenal realm, that are objects in themselves having not yet been perceived. And the only way you can kind of arrive at that, maybe with some confidence, is again looking at the structure of the theory, which seems, if you take the theory in what's called a realist way, where you say, well, I think the theory really is describing something that really exists, and that's why it works so well, and you look at the structure of the theory, that's what it's pointing to. It's pointing to this realm, this higher dimensional realm, if you will, that just simply cannot fit into space-time. But if you want to say, well, the theory's really talking about something real, then you kind of have to make room for it in your conceptual framework and say, maybe space-time is bigger than I thought. So we certainly can't use physical science, empirical science, to check it and say, yeah, we were right. It's just kind of a natural, rational approach if you want to say, well, I can now explain why this theory works so well because it's really describing something real. And if you don't say that, then you can have trouble explaining why the theory works so well. So that's the choices people have to make in terms of how are they going to interpret the theory.
I think maybe the biggest surprise I had, both from your book and from reading, following the online debate, was the concept of free will and the fact that physicists even debate this, that they try to come up with formulas and equations to kind of express it. Is free will an illusion? I mean, that's the central question for everybody who's listening to this program. Are we dominoes? Is there predestination? Give me your take on it.
Well, my answer is no, it's not an illusion, although it seems to be very popular among physicists to think that it is an illusion and that we should tell ourselves, yeah, you know, we're deluded and we don't really have free will. And a lot of physicists arrive at this impression because they view space-time in a certain way. They think that relativity theory is kind of telling you that there's a space-time map of the universe and that there's no distinction to be made between past, present, and future. That's really not a necessary conclusion that you have to arrive at from a relativity theory, but it is very compelling to some people who look at certain structures, the form of the theory, and how it seems to kind of commingle space and time. And I can see how it's a natural thing for impression for people to get that you have to kind of view future events as all being out there. But it's a mistaken impression to think that that's really forced on you. It really isn't forced on you. And my interpretation certainly gives an alternative viewpoint that of this sort of growing picture where events are brought about from the quantum realm. And in that process of being brought about, you're actually creating this space-time, and the future does not have to exist yet. So if that's the case, there's no fate. There's nothing out there where you know, your events in your future saying, okay, at such and such date next year, I'm going to do something, and I can't avoid it because it's already there in the future. Well, I totally dissent from that.
And is the whole question of free will, is that sort of the point where the quantum mechanics sort of clashes with classical physics? Is that the battleground, or am I simplifying
it? Well, there's a battleground apparently in there's an apparent incompatibility between quantum theory and relativity theory because of these issues such as non-locality, where you have apparently influences that seem to propagate faster than light. It's not so much about the free will issue because, again, a lot of people want to interpret quantum theory in a way that puts you in what's called a block world, this idea where all events, future, present, and past already exist. So it is possible to impose a particular kind of interpretation on quantum theory where you still get this block world and you still have fated events. But that's not really the incompatibility. The incompatibility is where you have these strange non-local influences that seem to exceed the speed of light. And that, of course, in my interpretation is explained by the idea that those processes are going on in this submerged sort of part of the iceberg, this part of reality that is not contained in space-time, and that relativity describes space-time processes only. So we don't have to worry about the fact that these quantum processes seem to not quite be constrained by relativity in some ways because they are not part of space-time.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, there's at least there's a positive spin on this, the idea that mental activity or our thoughts are not governed by classical physics. Let's take some calls from the audience, see what's on folks' minds out there. First-time caller, Josh in Mississippi. You picked a good program to be a first-time caller on. You're on with Dr. Ruth Kastner. Hi, Josh.
Hi. How are you guys doing tonight?
All right. What's on your mind?
Well, I had just a few questions. I was going to ask what her thoughts on the Global Consciousness Project, the Princeton Egg Project, if she's familiar with that. What her thoughts were on that, and the 100th monkey effect, if she's ever heard of that or given any thought into that. And
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with those specific terms. Is there a way can kind of describe it quickly?
Is the 100th monkey, is that sort of 100 monkeys in a room with typewriters write the great American novel? Is that what you mean?
Consciousness Project is a project that is run by Princeton, and it leads they have set up a series of basically random number calculators or random number generators that are isolated from each other, and based on the output of the random number generators, they have found patterns that have revolved around certain, say, global worldwide events that have been significant, and over time, they've used these patterns to actually predict events based on the output of the random number generators.
Hmm. That's interesting. I haven't heard about that at all, and I probably shouldn't speculate on it. And of course, the idea of random number generators, technically, there's no such thing, really. There's always something that's kind of contributing to the output in some way. And if the randomness would only come in at the quantum level. So I shouldn't say there's no such thing. I mean, at the quantum level, you could have some basic randomness. And the only kind of seed of interest maybe that's in there, that again, very speculative, and since I really haven't read about it, I don't want to comment too extensively on it. But once again, if we trace the randomness, if the only randomness that's happening with these numbers being generated is at the quantum level, then once again, according to my interpretation, that puts the source of the randomness in this pre-space-time realm of quantum possibilities. And those are areas where if we do identify that with consciousness or volition, which is one thing I talk about in terms of free will, then it's conceivable that there is some activity going on in that level that could then be manifested in the concrete world. But again, very speculative, and you know, but that's the most I could say about that.
And Josh, the 100th monkey?
because that would be a source to kind of link the two, in my opinion, because that actually gives hard data to both the quantum world and the physical world, as to speak, you know. And also the 100 monkey effect, if you've never actually read into that, kind of read into that a bit.
Okay, thank you for the call.
Okay,
appreciate it.
You.
We're going to go to the wild card line. Randy, who is trucking in Oregon. Hi, Randy. You're on with Dr. Ruth Kastner.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Kastner. My niece is a physicist, and she had a couple of quick thoughts that I would like to pass on to the doctor.
Okay.
The first one is the brain is hardware, the mind is software.
I love that. I've sort of thought that myself. So, yes, that's a nice way to understand it, that they are two different kinds of systems, software being more of an abstract plan, idea, design, and it can be implemented on a piece of hardware. So, yeah, go for it.
And the second thing she told me was that Niels Bohr made a response to Albert's statement about God does not play dice with the universe. She told me he responded, Albert, quit telling God what to do.
Say again?
Albert, quit telling God what to do.
We're telling God what to do.
Bohr's telling Einstein, Albert, quit telling God what to do was
oh.
the response.
Sorry. Yeah, interesting. Well, there we go. You know, have an open mind.
Hey, thanks.
Although I don't ultimately buy Bohr's, you know, Copenhagen interpretation, but yeah, that's good advice.
Randy, thank you for calling. Angela in Modesto on the wildcard line. Hi, Angela. You're on with Dr. Ruth Kastner.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. Given the fact that physics has now proven that I don't know how many trillions of a second after the Big Bang, the ingredients had to be just perfect to make our universe what it is, otherwise none of it would be here, including us. And as you've been talking, that there can be, you know, the hidden part of the iceberg, other realms or whatever, mm-hmm. such as heaven. Is it not prudent for physicists to pressure schools to teach intelligent design?
Well, I think most physicists would probably say that's not something we would know enough about to be able to pressure anyone. I mean, that's a great question and a big topic, and of course a big controversy. Now, as someone personally who believes that I've taught courses in science and religion, and I firmly believe that science and religion are not opposed. However, they deal with different domains of knowledge, different ways of knowing, and because science is an empirical kind of exploration, it always has to answer to measurement and testing and so on. I think physicists in particular would be going outside of their range of professional expertise to say that, you know, you should teach a particular scriptural approach to creation. I think that they really wouldn't be qualified to say something like that. Now, of course, there are arguments. It's a very deep question, and a lot of people say that given the order that we see in the universe, you know, couldn't there be, don't you have to require a creator? And there are some specific arguments as to why it isn't completely necessary from a physical point of view, but it's very debatable. It's certainly not something I could give you a satisfactory and complete answer in the time we have. But I respect your question, and my short answer is that it's a legitimate question to think about design in terms of the whole creation of the whole cosmos. Physics itself can't answer those kinds of questions, and we're really dealing with philosophical and spiritual and religious questions, and it's different ways of knowing, and physics just really can't say anything about it. Now, I know there are scientists who kind of try to use science as an argument against the existence of any sort of spiritual realm, and once again, I think they're going a little bit outside their area of expertise, because there's no way they can really know that, and there's no way that science can give any kind of authoritative answer to that. We're really dealing with the realms of philosophy.
Thanks, Angela. I guess the fact that the science and religion are not incompatible does not mean they're the same thing.
Oh, definitely. If you know, to quote Niels Bohr in a way, they're sort of complementary ways of knowing. They're very different ways of knowing, but I also think there's a possibility that they're both pointing toward the same reality, just from very different approaches.
I would imagine you get, as you discuss these ideas and how elegant all of this is, our understanding of reality, you get a lot of questions about God, and people see God's fingerprints all over the place.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an important question, and it goes to those issues of fundamental, ultimate beginnings, and I think any responsible physical, empirical scientist has to say, I can't make my science address that. I mean, even Charles Darwin said, I'm not talking about ultimate beginnings. If I'm correct, again, I'm not a biologist, but my understanding from what I've read is that he was talking in terms of evolution about something he felt he was seeing in the world. But he didn't claim that, like so many people think, that evolution is some argument that things just assemble themselves and by accident or by chance. I don't think he went there. I really think he kind of remained agnostic on that point and said, look, my discussion, my theory is not about ultimate beginnings. So he may have even left the door open for those kinds of creation ideas. And again, I don't want to come down either way. It's outside my realm of expertise, but I do want to point out that those are deeply philosophical questions. And they do go beyond the realm of empirical science.
We'll go back to the phones in a moment. We have about 3 minutes before we go to a break. You end the book with talking about a next revolution, sort of a paradigm shift. And the ones you've described in the past where humanity looks at reality in a much different way, I mean, those are sometimes violent changes. I mean, it takes a lot for us to get our heads around it. Is the next shift, I mean, how long does it take, and is it inevitable that we sort of end up looking at reality in a different way?
Well, I wish it were inevitable that we'd figure this out. I think it's right, but again, you don't know. I mean, it certainly, as I mentioned in the book, it took about two centuries for the heliocentric, the sun-centered model of the solar system to be accepted. So it's a very, very long process, and it's hard because your senses are telling you, look, I see the things going around the Earth. I can feel that the Earth isn't moving. It's very, we have these perceptions, and we have to actually question them and go beyond them in a certain way. So it's very counterintuitive, and I'm hopeful that people will see that I think this is the simplest way to understand why quantum theory works so well, because it really is talking about reality.
And you look at the history of physics, I mean, it's, as you mentioned, it sometimes takes a very long time. It might be 100 years, it might be 200 years, but you'll need somebody looking back at this to figure out who was right.
I suppose so.
And, I mean, I guess you'd like it to be you.
Well, you know, I think this is the best way to understand quantum theory. I don't want to be real dogmatic. I don't want to be, as a philosopher, it's my job to try to keep an open mind as much as possible and to try to understand the opposing views. And I think one problem with many researchers is they get very attached to their picture and they can't conceive that it might be wrong. And I try to be careful about that. To me, whenever I look at this model and apply it to a new question, it always seems to work. It's a very impressive model. And again, I credit John Kramer, who was the originator of the basic transactional model. So I just continue to find it to be a very fruitful model, but I have to be responsible and I have to be prepared to be shown that maybe it is wrong. So,
well, as you note in the book, I mean, sort of every advance in science and our knowledge is a lesson in humility for humanity. The less significant we seemingly become with some of these advances. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Ruth Kastner about her book, Understanding Our Unseen Reality. You can go back to the phone lines right after this on Coast to Coast AM. The song is Cosmically Conscious. Paul McCartney wrote that in 1968 while he was with the Beatles in India, but it was never released as a single until he was on his own in 1993. I thought it was a perfect fit for tonight's discussion. Hope you've had as much fun as I have with Dr. Ruth Kastner. It's kind of cool to stretch the limits of what we do on the program and consider some of these big questions like this. The phone lines are full, so apparently you agree with me, and we'll get to as many of your calls as we can right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Ruth Kastner, you seem to have touched a nerve. The lines are full. A lot of folks want to talk to you. Let's go east of the Rockies. Chuck in Georgia. Hi, Chuck. You're on with Dr. Ruth Kastner.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Hey, Chuck, we can't hear you. You want to try give it one more try? You're breaking up.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Chuck. We can't hear you. We're just getting little syllables there. We're going to go west of the Rockies, Jim in Fresno, California. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First time calling you.
Sure.
Did you know that Dark Shadows had a parallel universe about three different ways? And then my question happened to do with space travel, with floating of the space and time for the aliens and people to be able to travel for the kind of distance that we would like to be able to do, and like we're currently able to do at this time.
What I'm not sure what you're asking. Are you asking, are you asking about how time changes when you travel at the speed of light, or what?
No, I'm referring to like a floating like a map to do, like floating it up along with time and space to be able to go ahead and go that fast. To be able to go for them to go ahead and get to like another universe and so on.
Yep, I'm not sure how to tackle that one, Ruth.
I think I know what he's asking, and I think the answer is probably no. That I don't think we can do that in terms of really enhanced propulsion capabilities and so on. And again, that's not really my field, and it's not really what my book is about. But looking at the extremes of the top speeds and so on that we can achieve, again, we're limited by relativity. And so quantum theory can't help us with that in the space-time realm. We're still kind of limited by that. So not quite my field, but I suspect the answer is probably no.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We're going to try the international line. Stuart in Alberta, Canada. Hi, Stuart. Good morning. You're on with Dr. Ruth Kastner.
Absolute pleasure to be on the program, and an honor to be speaking to you, because just a fascinating topic for me. I wanted to make a point about like something that I discovered in my, just the way I look at things, is that to think that we've been here for apparently billions of years since, you know, this Earth came into existence and stuff, and life started to slowly develop, and we evolved to these creatures that are as advanced as we are now, that we can discuss this topic today. Mm-hmm. Internationally, worldwide, on the internet, knowledge being shared amongst everybody. And I just think, in billions of years, I'm here to witness this in this time, and I can influence so much in this little window of time. And it just seems to me, what are the odds of that when this whole timeline is billions and billions of years? It's so astronomical. That's putting the numbers to the consciousness. So I asked myself, am I living in a fake reality? Because this is like a movie playing out. And I say, you know, what effect can I have in this whole movie? And what kind of effect can we all have if we all just kind of be aware of what's going on? It just seems so astronomical. Like, it seems like, what kind of coincidence would that be, that we can all be witnessing this here and now? So I just have trouble quantifying that all.
Well, Stuart, I don't know if you got a question, but I'll bet Ruth has some thoughts on where you're going, because I've had those same thoughts about the nature of reality, and sometimes it just doesn't feel very real.
Well, it's an interesting observation, and I think that the caller is, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Stuart.
But kind of, Stuart is kind of reporting his ability to really step back for a second and kind of take a window seat, if you will, to this vessel that we're kind of riding on, and go, wow, look out the window, this is amazing. And to me, that's kind of the philosophical approach to life. It's stepping back from, you know, how we all have our daily lives, and we we got to make money, and we got to plan what we're going to make for dinner, and we got to get through our day and these mundane details. But it's really great if you can get that point of view where you have the ability to step back. Maybe someone else is making dinner for you or whatever, and you can go, wow, this is so amazing. And that's really what's motivated me, that I've always had this feeling that I need to stop and go, I know this reality that we're in is so incredible and so rich, and I don't want to miss it. I want to try to figure out what's really going on. And I've always kind of had this sense that there's probably a little bit more going on than meets the eye. And that's just a hunch I've had. But I think when we get that moment to stop and think about it, it really is an astounding reality that we're in. And I think it's always great if we have that opportunity to examine it further and look at our best theories and try to say, you know, why are they working so well? Maybe they're pointing to something that isn't obvious. Sort of like that Zen saying about the finger pointing at the moon. You can, if you get stuck looking at the finger, someone's trying to point you to something. They want you to see something that's not right in front of you. And if all you're looking at is that finger, you're never going to get beyond it and see what the message really is. So I think it's a great observation, and thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks, Stuart. Well put, Ruth. Wildcard line, Frank in Houston. Good morning, Frank.
Hello, Mr. Knapp and Dr. Kastner.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a couple of statements, and the best thing I ever heard about time was someone said on the internet that time is not a thing. It's not a thing you can step into. In other words, we can calculate the size of a pyramid, but you can't wrap a mathematical equation around time because it really doesn't exist. Dr. Kastner may have a comment on that. I'd appreciate that. And the other thing is, well, if time doesn't exist, well, how can God predict the future and prophecy and all these things? Because only He who created everything can know, in a simple, very simple way to state it, is from a molecular point of view, He can create everything, and He knows the logical end of what that molecular logical movement would be. So,
Frank, we kind of put Ruth on the spot already about the God part of it, so I'm going to let her off the hook on this one. If she wants to tackle the first part about time not being a thing, take a crack at it.
Okay, well, yeah, I agree with that, and in my book I talk about how time is kind of just a way of describing change. So what I argue is that change is real, and that's what transactions are about. That's what bringing space-time events into being is about. Things change, and we experience that. We can see them changing. So change is real, and it happens in a certain way. And when we're describing changes, time is really the concept we use to describe change. So I would agree with the caller that, you know, you can kind of say time doesn't exist as kind of a substance that you can measure. It's really describing the process of change. But actually, he asked a really interesting question about God, and, you know, of course, I won't get into that now. But the short answer to that is that if you have quantum randomness and quantum indeterminacy, there are certain views of God that could say that the God is actually involved in that whole process of bringing about events. And there are very many different views of God, but there is one view in which He's a participating God. That's called the process idea of God. That God is somehow involved in the creating of events and at some level doesn't really know exactly what's going to happen. But of course that's a very controversial issue, and the point is that there are very many different concepts of God.
Thank you, Frank. We're going to go to the first time caller list, our line, Jerry in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Jerry. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah, I called Art Bell about 15 years ago on this too and talked to him real quick. He was going to a break and just said, boy, that was a wild experience. Here's my story. In approximately 1962, while I was watching Walt Disney's Wide World of Color, it was always on a Sunday night, remember? And then I went into this room to get a drumstick out of the freezer, one of the ice cream things, nuts on it. And as I went into that room, this is like about 52 years ago or so, I was a young child, this thing descended from the ceiling. It's like a fog it was. It was a winter night in Michigan here, and while that fog came out of the ceiling, it was approximately 2 feet long by maybe 1 foot wide, and it was like an undulating being, as Linda Moulton Howe would say, an interdimensional being. Street sense of fear went across my body, and it held me, and then all of a sudden it let go of me after holding me for about 25 seconds, and then it proceeded to lift out of the ceiling. Okay, it happened one other time.
Hey, Jerry.
Yeah.
We're sort of off the topic for Ruth here. Do you have a sort of a question that deals with the topic that we're discussing tonight, understanding our unseen reality, quantum mechanics?
Sure. That things like this would happen to younger children rather than older children, older people. And as far as time is concerned, I think that this being, or whatever it was, knew how old I was. Or, you know, it happens to children more than it never happened to me again, except when
I was
sleeping.
I appreciate the call, and I think it's a really interesting story you're telling for another program, but not for this one tonight. Thanks for calling. We're going to go to the wild card line. Joe in the Bronx. Hi, Joe. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
I just wanted to ask your guest, Dr. Ruth Kastner, given the existence of the afterlife, does time and space exist in the afterlife?
Well, if you take the afterlife as something that definitely exists, which I really can't comment on because I'm sort of a physicist philosopher, and that's not really my field, so it'd be very speculative for me. But if there is a spiritual realm such as that, then it certainly is a reasonable thing to conceive of that as being associated with this realm of quantum possibilities in some way, simply because it's more abstract and it is outside the space-time realm. That's really all I could say about it, and I certainly wouldn't take a position that there really is an afterlife and it has that correspondence. But it's certainly conceivable, and somebody could argue that.
Thanks, Joe. Gary in Santa Maria, California, wildcard line. Hi, Gary.
Well, thank you very much. I kind of feel like a lightweight getting in the ring with a heavyweight, but I'll give it my best shot here.
Okay. All right.
It seems to me that quantum mechanics and astrology are faced with the two challenges, that is retrocausality time travel, and where astrology would come into it is that all the planets are set in a separate, very defined orbit that's completely calculable into the future and into the past. Now, a lot of people will immediately say that that the clock doesn't control me. No, it doesn't. It's a reflection of what's happening out there. The clock says it's 5 o'clock. The clock's not making it 5 o'clock. It's reflecting the fact that it is 5 o'clock. So if your clock is set at 7 different times, or 9 different times according to the planets, each one causes a certain thing to happen, which will then again repeat in the future. And people are so insistent, and they completely confuse newspaper astrology with real astrology. That's like saying a snake oil salesman is on the same par as practicing medicine as a neurosurgeon. When you get into the real math of real astrology and just understand it's identifying patterns forward and backward, and that each clock, your Pluto clock, takes 248 years to move 1 year, where your little Mercury clock moves 4.5 times faster than the clock on Earth, and astrology tracks every single one of them forward and backward. So it can predict as well as be historical. And the influences of the planets in their set orbit are both predictive and historical. And I wondered if the doctor was able to comment on that, or if anybody followed me at all.
Well, I might have a little bit to say about it. And I think what you mean is that really distinguishing between sort of a astrological horoscope type approach and an astronomy, which is what's called astronomy now. Celestial mechanics of the orbits of the planets and so on. And that is correct that, of course, we have those classical laws that are very good at describing the motion of those kinds of bodies, the planets orbiting the sun. And once again, those laws seem to have that time symmetry. They seem to go either direction in time. And that's what's so tricky about trying to figure out, well, does that mean we really could go back in time or what? What exactly does it mean that we can use these laws either way? And it's a very tricky point, because just because you can say, well, I can predict what's going to happen, and then at the classical level, if you've been accurate about your inputs and the information you've put in, you usually can find out that you're right, and they work very well, and then you can use them to retrodict what you said, go back and say, back in, you know, 300 years ago, here's where the planet Jupiter was. And that's why these macroscopic classical laws are, it's what's called deterministic, that they have this single-valued kind of quality where you put in information at any time and you can kind of make them go forward or backward. But quantum mechanics works very differently, and we have to be careful about assuming this idea that we can go in either direction at that level. So it's a very complicated question, but you're right that there is that quality about those classical laws that they can kind of be used in either direction.
Thanks for the call. Interesting concept. Sharon in Missouri might be our last call here. Hi, Sharon. You're on with Dr. Ruth Kastner.
Okay, Dr. Kastner, I've enjoyed listening to you tonight, and this kind of popped into my mind listening to you. What if our perception of reality and our participation in it takes place in a great collective dream of atoms? Of atoms' dreams, ATOMS, dreams.
Oh, I'm sorry. Which word are you spelling out here?
Atoms.
Atomic
little particles.
Oh,
atoms.
Okay. Well, I love that. That's very poetic. And, you know, I think Carl Jung, the famous psychologist, would just love that, because, of course, he had this idea of the collective unconscious. And it's certainly one could put that interpretation on this. It's not something I would go, yeah, you know, I'm going to endorse that. But it's certainly something that is arguable, where you could suggest that this quantum level, this unseen aspect to reality, this higher dimensional pre-space-time realm, could be some realm in which the individual consciousnesses that we have as humans could possibly become more aware of each other and act on a collective level. And so certainly you wouldn't be the first one to suggest that, and neither would I, and Carl Jung may have had exactly that notion in mind, that if we go to this deeper level, we might find that we're all able to unify our individual consciousnesses in some coordinated way. In fact, this reminds me of Deepak Chopra, because I think he would like this idea very much, that he thinks, you know, in a certain spiritual tradition coming from the East, that we are all one in some sense, and that our individual consciousnesses are kind of a fragmented aspect of that unity. So it's a very interesting thought.
Here's a quote from him. He said, "The consistent reality you wake up to every day is not a personal consciousness, but a shared intersubjective human consciousness. At night in your dreams, that's personal." Now, that's a wild idea. We'd need another half an hour for that one.
Right.
Dr. Kastner, Ruth, it was great to have you on the show. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. I can't imagine how you're going to top a book like this, because understanding our unseen reality, it's a lot to chew on, and we greatly appreciated having you here.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much, and thank you for inviting me.
All righty. Thank you very much, and we'll have you back again sometime. Thanks also to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Gina Salvati, Jeff Duray, webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani, and Chris Boros, and thanks also to our earlier guest, Rob Mercer, and, of course, to Dr. Ruth Kastner. George Norrie will be here later tonight. Hope you can tune in. I'll be back next Sunday. Good night, everyone.